Good morning, Arizona homeowners. Thank you for tuning in to Rosie on the House as we head around the corner here and find Mr. Harper out in the garden this morning, getting ready to work on a little bit of lawn repair too. Looks like.
Well,
lawn transition.
It is
maybe
that
is a better word.
It is that ugly duckling stage for a lot of lawns, and you know the lawns have an identity crisis right now, and they've had we had 108 degrees a couple weeks ago that kind of started the transition pretty effectively. It started burning the ryegrass up. Then it's been 78 and, 50 at night.
But we're not complaining.
No, absolutely not. But it looks like we're headed to more normal temperatures, from here through next week, right around 100. So that's going to help the transition. And when I say help, you want the ryegrass to die now. You need to force it out, because what happens far too often about mid-July, people come into the nursery and say, my lawn died. Like, no, your ryegrass finally died, and it stayed alive so long, you're right. Your Bermuda grass is now dead underneath. It will not come back. It has been squashed out, dominated by the ryegrass, and it can only stay dormant for so long, and it finally dies. So mow your lawn shorter. Don't increase the water. I'm not a big advocate of turning water off, although a lot of people do, and it is a successful way to do it, but that causes some stress to the Bermuda grasses that are underlying as well. But if you at least just don't increase it, and you mow it quite a bit shorter, even scalping it, dethatch it, aerate it, any of those types of things that will get in and get rid of that ryegrass canopy and remove that canopy. Your lawn's going to be ugly either way, so you might as well have it kind of be ugly all at one time by scalping and thatching and have it be brown, and then have it come back in a little more orderly fashion. Then the normal transition, if you don't do anything else at all, is just going to be a spot here, a spot there, a spot here. And we get those calls too. I got a spot, it's just not dying, but that just particular spot, the soil's a little harder. Maybe the sprinklers don't quite reach it as well. So the ryegrass is dying quicker there. So force the transition by mowing the lawn short, dethatching. I'd love it if people, I had a guy in the nursery, I wanted to hug him the other day. He actually had rented an aerator. He was scalping. He had thatched, and he was aerating. He goes, now what, I want it. I said, man, here you go. We loaded him up with soil sulfur and some good organic Hickman's lawn food. And, I said, man, get those holes opened up, go over this with all of this, kind of maybe brush it, rake it back in, chop those cores up. I'm anxious to hear from him in another week or so and see how his lawn turned out. But any of those processes you can do to get rid of that ryegrass.
I'm way overdue for core aerating. It's been about 4 years since I did it. But the year I did it, John, I know I used at least a third less water to get the same results. More than likely.
And even if you don't, the lawn's just going to look better. If you've got places that have a hard time growing grass because they're hard and compacted, with the same amount of water, you're going to have a whole lot nicer lawn. But certainly, there isn't a golf course hardly in the state that doesn't aerify.
Gosh.
And they're getting ready to do it right now. So, they're going through the same thing. And they either aerify or they really deeply run the blades of the thatcher down there and kind of create the same deal. And get rid of that old thatch, open that soil up, get some fertilizer on it, and man, that it just
when you core aerate, you just let the plugs dissolve back into the ground.
Chop. What I do is go over it with the mower with no catcher.
After you've aerated, you've got all these plugs laying out on the ground.
I got the plugs laying on the ground. Then I put my granular sulfur on and my lawn food pellets on, and then I take the mower, take the thatcher off, and I just go around and chop it all up.
Well, Scotty's Lawnmower Service must love you.
Yeah.
Blade sharpening.
Yeah.
Jay must have core aerated.
If that stuff's pretty wet and soft, and oh, by the way, if you're going to core aerate, water really good a day or two before you do that, or that aerator just be bouncing you all over the place. And mark your sprinkler heads. Do not go over a sprinkler head with a Thatcher or a Core aerator. Yeah, well, I usually wait to get my lawn sharp. You know, then that's a good time to take. After you do all of that, you're probably not going to have to mow for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
Then take your mower in for the season service, tune-up, sharpening, after you've done all of that, because it's you're not going to need it for, yeah, at least 2 weeks probably. So, yeah, they do love me. I'm in there sharpening all the time because I run over stuff I shouldn't run over with my lawnmower.
I use mine as a grader.
Yeah, I had to buy a new mower the other day because I took it in. He goes, I can't fix it anymore. It's going to cost you. I've got to use. He always usually has some pretty good rebuilt McLean's
there.
It's like, I got one here. It's only going to be about $50 more than what it's going to cost. I said, done. Load it up. Let's go.
1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. If you've got a question about your landscape or garden, it's 1-888-767-4348. Let's start off this morning with Larry in Black Canyon City. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
How may we help you?
I got a 20 by 40 foot garden, and I wanted to get some sunscreen for it, and I seen it on the internet, and they go, well, what percentage of sunblock do you want? 30%, 40%, 50%, goes on to 80%. Well, which one should I get?
Probably the lightest, 30 or 40. I wouldn't go any heavier than 50 for sure. You get it too shady, you're going to have all kinds of problems. And usually 30 to 40% is enough to take the curse off, to just, you know, get it enough shade that you can carry plants through the summer into the hot weather as good as you need to.
Okay, yeah, so I was kind of curious about it because, you know, they got it on the internet, but they don't tell you.
Well, they don't tell you because they don't know, and it would vary on where you are in the country. But I go as light as possible, and unless you're trying to grow super tropical stuff that needs tons of shade, if you're just shading a vegetable garden and trying to lengthen the season, 30 or 40% is plenty.
And there are screens for windows, and there's also screens for garden. A lot of them call them agricultural cloth.
Correct. Yes.
And that can be a different pricing point.
Yeah. You want to buy, you know, the appropriate material. You don't want fancy colors. You know, you want all of that. Just, you know, most of those are too dense anyway. And then there's some local companies here that will size that, sew it, grommet it if you wanted a custom size. It will last a lot longer if you've got sewn taped edges and grommets in it than if you just have cut frayed edges and you're trying to string something through those cut edges. So,
I ordered mine from Phoenix Tent and Awning down on McDowell, the oldest license holder in Arizona.
Contractor's license holder?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've been around a long time.
So there's a good resource for you, Larry. I know that's a ways from Black Canyon City, but it'll be worth the drive if it's the right product.
You know, that kind of product, again, you give them the measurements, they can do it and mail it to you or FedEx it to you too.
Now, what are you trying to protect this time of year out in the garden? Everything's burned up, right?
Well, I wouldn't think.
Melon
no.
season.
Well, it really shouldn't be. I mean, tomatoes, I'm just picking my first tomatoes. Now and they're fine. You know, 100 degrees even with its, you know, mid 60s, upper 60s, low 70s at night is not going to burn tomatoes, not if they're watered properly. It's over 105 and in the, you know, 80s at night that you probably, if you want to extend it, that's when you need to extend it. Now, if you've still got some winter stuff, maybe spinach or lettuces or those types of things, I don't even know that shading's going to help that. You know, it's just going to get too warm for them. Then they're going to stretch if they're too shady. So you should be transitioning out of those. It's probably a little late to plant most anything much, you know, other than melons and cucumbers and eggplant and okra and those types of things. And none of those things need any shade screening at all. So, you know, the shade screening thing is just to kind of probably try and stretch your tomatoes and peppers into the summer. And they're just now maybe needing to think about shading. You shouldn't have had to shade at all till even yet.
And for the gardener, it's a nice touch when you're out there.
Well, it's creature comfort. Yeah, people come into the nursery and say, oh, this stuff under the shade. I say, well, this is here for you.
Plant doesn't need it.
Most of these plants don't need that, but it's here for you, so that you'll spend more time walking around here.
Now, we had an interview last year with the giant pumpkin grower contest that y'all waited at Harper's.
Next weekend.
That's next weekend.
Next weekend.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, and they've got a couple of non-pumpkin entries this year, a couple of big squashes. And I think I might be mistaken, but I think there's 8 or 9 pumpkins entered. I saw some pictures of them the other day. They're huge. They're coming along good. So,
they're mostly growing around what part?
Most of these guys are the originator and the guy that holds the state record is at the Scottsdale Community Gardens.
Okay.
Right there behind Scottsdale Community College on the Indian Reservation.
And that was 400 and something pounds, if I remember right.
Or 486 pounds, thereabouts.
And you just turn it into a big mulch after that, a big compost?
They save the seeds, and then the rest is compost.
So that's next weekend you're doing
next Saturday at our location on Hayden Road, just south of Thomas. Yes.
We'll have to get a live stream reporter out there for the big final moment of...
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Kind of goes along with your urban garden topic next Saturday.
Perfect. 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. You can text questions to 411-923. And if you need a little help with plant or insect identification, you can take a picture and email it to info@rosieonthehouse.com, and we'll put our resources together for you to get you the best possible answer and information we can. On this beautiful Arizona Saturday morning, we find ourselves at Alice's house in Phoenix talking about her tomatoes. Good morning. It's Rosie on the house.
Good morning. I have several plants of the big tomatoes, and I don't remember which variety I bought, but almost all of those big ones are splitting. What's causing that?
Well, we have intense sunshine and dry air, and it just kind of tends to split tomatoes here. There's not a heck of a lot you can do it other than that shade clothing that we do, not so much to protect the plants, but it will reduce some of the splitting on tomatoes. And it's just a little bit of an inherent problem when you when you grow those great big varieties here, because we just have so many hours of pretty intense sunshine and very low humidity. You will usually find that the ones that are further back under the plant, that are shaded more by the vine itself, are less likely to split. One thing that can cause it is irregular watering and fertilizing. If you have too inconsistent, sometimes let them get a little dry and then you water them good, that can cause that shrinking and expanding to be too drastic. That can add to it, but most of the time it's just a condition of our environment. And in most cases, you're just not going to win the prettiest tomato contest. They're still fine. They're edible.
Still eat them.
Yeah. I think we can grow some of the ugliest tomatoes here, but they're still good eating.
Right. And then also, I tried growing corn before, and I never got any corn on the cob. So I tried it again this year, and they're all up and stuff, and with the wind. I understand, I looked on the internet how to self-pollinate them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm trying, but my corn still looks very little, and with all the wind, I don't know if they've gotten pollinated because the wind is just beating everything to death here.
Well, the wind actually helps pollinate, but the mistake most people make with corn is they plant, just one or two long rows of it instead of planting, multiple rows or more of a block or a clump of corn, because it's harder for it to get pollinated if it's just in a couple of long, narrow rows.
So, I have three rows, and I have about 30 plants in there, so I have three rows of them in a block, like a square.
Okay. Well, that certainly will help. It sounds like you might, you know, if the corn's still pretty little, you might even be a little late. You know, corn now should be, in fact, they're starting to harvest sweet corn now, you know, in the valley, the guys that grow it. They start that, you know, back in February probably, and it's up and being harvested by the end of May. So it's kind of a real critical timing thing. Corn probably isn't the best thing for a home gardener with a little limited space to try and grow. It takes a lot of space. It takes a lot of water. And quite frankly, you can buy really good sweet corn pretty cheap. So,
and like you said,
you can go see Mark Freeman over in Mesa and buy really good sweet corn here. And I don't know, maybe this weekend or next weekend.
Oh, last time Julie was in, when we covered corn, she brought it from there raw, and we were just eating it in the studio raw.
Yeah, not even cooked.
Oh,
yeah,
it was
sweet
incredible.
As sugar. Yeah.
But you can follow the Arizona Corn Trail from now until about October from Maricopa County up to whatever county Snowflake's in. Was that, that's not Greenlee yet, is it?
Snowflake
Navajo. Mm-hmm. Up until about the end of October. So we've got plenty of corn. Yeah. So let's get to Frank in Tucson next on the line at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. Good morning, Frank.
Hey, good morning, guys. You guys are fantastic. I love listening to you. Listen, I got a dilemma here. For Mother's Day, of course, I have three beautiful daughters, and they all brought these lilies. They like these lilies for my wife. Now, I'm pretty good with bushes, flowers in my backyard. It looks pretty good back there. But we went away for a couple of days, and I came back, and we put the lilies out on our patio, and I watered them before I left. But they look kind of peaked. I'm just wondering, how delicate are those? And my wife's telling me she read some time back something in the newspaper where you take the bulbs out and put them away in the refrigerator till next spring. I never heard of such a thing.
Okay. Well, that there are certain bulbs that you have to do that with, like tulips and hyacinths and some crocus and things like that that have to be chilled for the come. But lilies, typically, and there's lots of different kinds of lilies, so it's hard to tell you for sure that they probably don't need refrigerated. They're going to have to be in a pretty shady, protected area. But there are lilies that will come back, even Easter lilies. I had an Easter lily plant that came back for several years, but it was in, you know, a pretty deep, shady place. So I would probably take them out of the pots and find a good, shady spot in the garden to plant them rather than trying to keep them alive in a pot. That would be my advice.
We appreciate the call, Frank, and good luck saving those lilies for Mama. And we've got Nancy on the line next, and an open line for you at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. We'll hear with you every Saturday morning for 29 years. If you've got a landscape or garden question, now is your time to call in. Let's get right to it. Nancy's been holding, and we're going to see how we can help her right now at Rosie on the House. 1-888-767-4348. Calling from Maryville. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning. My question is, I have some young fruit trees, and I was kind of concerned about the bark getting sunburned because they really haven't had a chance to put on a lot of leaves. And I've seen people paint the trunks of fruit trees white. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably helps with the sunburning and probably with insect issues as well. And I'm just wondering, rule of thumb about painting trunks and what, you know, how high up would you go and what kind of paint would you use and that sort of.
Okay. Well, protecting the trunks of young, smooth-skinned trees like pecan trees, fruit trees, citrus trees, ash trees is critical because if they do sunburn, that's permanent damage and shortens the life of the tree or just kills the tree. So whether you use a, they make a white gauze tree wrap. You can make a big collar out of cardboard and just kind of staple it. It doesn't even need to touch the trunk of the tree, but just kind of make a long, narrow tube or collar out of it. Tree trunk paint. You want to use tree trunk paint, whether it's white or the Go Natural that's naturally colored if you're objectionable to the white coloring of the trunks. But any of those are absolutely vital. And boy, now would be the time to get it on before the real hot weather sets in. You bet.
And she wanted to know how high up into the branch. Once you're into the leaf structure.
First leaf, you know, basically. Yeah, you don't want to start painting over buds and nodes and things like that. But up high is basically the first branch, first limb, first leaf occurrence, that sort of thing.
Those tree trunk paints are made to breathe. You don't want to put on a house paint that's made to not breathe.
Correct.
And choke out your tree.
Correct.
So,
and it doesn't have to be a paint. A wrap works just fine. I was just down in Southeast Arizona with a lot of newly planted pecan trees, and they use kind of a cardboard collar, and the little trees just kind of down in the middle of that. So, you know, however you do it, you really have to do it. You want to make sure that trunk doesn't get sunburned.
And I know it's a little ways from you in Maryville, but on 7th Avenue, north of Campbell Avenue, Artistic Arborist is there. Mm-hmm. And they'll have more options than you knew existed for trunk protection, burlap wraps and everything Jay was talking about. So there's an option for you. I believe they are closed today, though, so local nurseries also carry a lot of those
products
as well.
Paint and wrap, probably. Yeah.
Perfect. All right, let's see. Tiffany's next on the line at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. Good morning, ma'am.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I had some Canary Island pines that I had planted in a house about 15 years ago, and I just loved them. And we moved to a new home, and I tried to find them, at your nursery and several others in the valley, and nobody sells them anymore. So I figured I was either going to have to go to California and get some and bring them back, or I thought I'd try eBay, and I ordered 12 seeds for $2.38, and they have come up, and I'm growing them in little trays, and I'm just wondering at what point or how big do they get before I try to move them outside and transition them?
Well, if they're up and sprouted, I'd probably move them outside. I would probably get them outside in a shady spot.
Okay.
For a little while, let them get up maybe 3 or 4 inches tall. Then I would probably repot them into, you know, like a 1 gallon nursery pot. And again, probably keep them in the shade all this first summer.
Okay.
Then next fall, you know, depending on how much they've grown, they could be bumped again into a little bit bigger pot and probably transitioned out into a more sunny location. It'd probably be a year or two before they're big enough to plant in the ground.
Okay.
But, that's about the only way you're going to get a Canary Island pine these days. I haven't seen one in a nursery in years.
I know, and I love them. They're so tall and elegant.
They really are. We've got a couple growing on our grounds at our nursery in Scottsdale, and they're fabulous.
Aleppo pine sure seem to be pine tree I see out there more now.
Well, more Eldericas probably than anything. Aleppos even have, because of their
I'm
size.
I'm sorry. That one.
Eldericas, Goldwater, Mondo, whichever name you want to call it.
I can't find an Aleppo.
Yeah, Aleppos you can find occasionally, but But Canary Islands, they've just all but disappeared.
And is that a water issue? Is that this other Eldericas more hardy?
It's a good question. I think the limited production of the Canary Islands, California, kind of gobbles them up, I think. Very popular pine there. The nice thing about them is they're pretty vertical. They don't take up a lot of room like an Aleppo or even an Eldericka can get a little spready. And the Canary Islands are much more vertical. You could grow them in a smaller area. I don't know.
It does seem like a funny thing to plant in the desert, but I love those irrigated lots where you come up and they've just got that row of pine on the end of it. It just
there's still some areas in town that, you know, that they're a good choice for.
Well, good luck with your Canary Island pines, Tiffany. Let's move to Ryan out in Apache Junction at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir.
All right. So my question is I'm still kind of new to gardening. I've been doing it for about a year and a half, 2 years. And my brother and I decided we're going to go a little bit bigger scale. My yard is all caliche clay, and we've been getting truckloads of wood chips dropped off as an attempt to build a good base soil. And my question was, is there any way to speed up the process other than just letting, you know, nature do its thing as far as the wood chips decomposing?
Yeah, you know what? Hang on. Let me get the number of our realtor for you here.
Well, composting can be sped up by adding, you know, a number of things to it. You know, one would be, you know, manures or, you know, some organic material that's already in the process of or is composting. You can, you know, adding moisture to it, adding accelerants like nitrogen to it. It's probably going to compost quicker if you pile it and keep it maybe even covered with, you know, plastic or something to get it some heat in there and keep the moisture in there and turn it on occasion. Just putting it in the ground, though, and letting it compost in the ground is going to take a while unless I would advocate buying, you know, chicken manure or dairy manure or something and adding it to that to speed it up.
Okay, and that's one of the things we were talking about. We're actually going to be raising chickens as well, and we're going to build a chicken tractor around the whole area and just kind of let the chickens go to town on it. So, I mean, but yeah, we could pick up more manure. That would help speed up the process. And
yeah, but again, you know, it's not composted. You know, it's pretty hot when it's fresh. So you want to make sure you're probably, again, I would suggest you make a big pile and you start a compost pile and use the manure with the wood chips, with any yard waste or green waste, and let that compost before you start tilling it into the ground. You can compost on top of the ground too, but once you start tilling that uncomposted material into the ground, it can actually take nitrogen out of the ground away from what you're trying to grow to fuel the composting process. So have some that you're composting, and then as it's composted, you know, start working it into the ground, and then you're always composting as you create material. So you kind of always have some that's working. Now, you can throw wood chips on top of the ground around your plants as a mulch, and that's no problem at all because it's not, you know, it's not down in the ground trying to decompose. And that's a good practice to mulch. It holds down weeds. It holds in moisture. It cools the soil down. So I would still advocate doing that. But if you're talking about working things into the soil, it really needs to be pretty well composted before you want to do that.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Hey, Ryan, one last thing for you. I have not watched it because I haven't had an hour and 40 minutes to sit in front of YouTube and pay attention. But there's a program called Back to Eden. Just search that, Back to Eden. John Eisenhower of Integrity Tree Service turned it on to me, and I've talked to about a dozen people that have watched it and said, if you follow that step, you will have the best soil you can imagine within a two-year time frame. So if you got an hour and 40 minutes to sit down and watch it, just Google Back to Eden documentary.
Okay.
We're going to move to Jim, still in the East Valley. Good morning, sir. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So I have a waterfall that I had put in, and I made the mistake of hiring somebody that wasn't a legitimate contractor. And so now I have a problem. It's pretty good looking, but it doesn't hold water, and so it runs out on my patio.
That could be a problem.
I'm wondering what I can do to fix the thing from running. Now, I had it built as a pondlet. Doesn't have a lot of basin to it. It just recirculates the water. But it runs out the patio, you know, runs out the bottom. So there's no integrity to hold the water in.
So they just used rock and cement or what?
They used a plastic stuff from Home Depot, a fountain.
A kit? So it's got a hard plastic liner?
There's not a hard plastic. It's soft. It's like a heavy black mill.
Okay.
And they coated that, you know, down the waterfall. Mm-hmm. Before they put the rock on, they put it down the cinder block and build it into a basin. But obviously, they didn't seal the basin.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but you know, I think you're probably talking about just rebuilding the whole thing, if that's the case. If where it's leaking from is in the basin, I don't know how else you solve that problem without taking it apart.
Can I ask you a question, Jim?
Sure.
That plastic liner coming down the waterfall, can we cut that and remove the liner from the basin?
Yes. Yeah, that can be done.
All right. Well, if you do that, then you can coat the inside of that basin with an epoxy waterproof plaster called Thoroseal. And that
Thoroseal.
And that will protect the integrity of your basin. It won't leak.
Okay. Where is the best place to get that?
Marvell Masonry.
Okay.
And it's
on Country Club in Mesa. We'll be the closest one to you.
Yeah, and in fact, Jim, if you'll take a picture of the fountain and send it to us at info@rosieonthehouse.com, with your phone number, we actually have your phone number here. Let me take a look at that. I think we can probably fix that. I would want, John, you would want to keep enough of that plastic apron to protect the integrity of the waterfall feature.
Correct.
Then you'd want to have a little skirt of it coming over
flap
the Thoroseal.
That comes over the top of that.
Yeah. So depending on what you've already spent and keeping you from having to tear it all down and start from scratch, send us a picture and let me see if we can't engineer something over the internet machine.
I'm ready.
Water features are tough in Arizona. I will say, I don't know any that end up lasting very long. They get tired of maintenance. I mean, right here at this turnabout.
Fountains are ponds, streams.
That makes a little more sense.
They're more self-contained, but fountains.
They end up garden planters.
I love what the pond gnome does.
Yeah.
Living ponds.
Those balanced biological ecosystems that they build. And if you want a fountain, they have that pondless water feature that there's no pond visible. It's all buried underneath in a plastic cistern. So you have no standing water to worry about. And you just have the sound and the look of water rushing down a natural rock feature, and you, the sound is what I want. Mm-hmm. It's the sound of water. And the next best thing, if you want a little fountain type thing, they're pondless, and you take they do them out of a lot of features. One I have in my front yard is a ceramic feature. It looks like a ceramic pot turned upside down, and the water just trickles out of the top and it runs down the thing, and then it sits on top of a big plastic tub with a grate on top, and you put rocks or whatever over the top so you don't see any standing water. There's no splash. The water isn't going everywhere, and you just get that sound of that soothing white noise sound of some water going. But the Italian, big Italian fountains and stuff that you see are be prepared for some maintenance and work on those. They take some upkeep.
The little lions spitting in the water. Yeah. The little naked boys peeing in the water.
Right, right, yeah.
So you say all the time when somebody calls in about an avocado, and you're like, well, they don't really do good here, but I hate to say that because every time we say that, somebody calls in, or we're talking about tulips or something like that. Well, we had somebody send in a banana tree picture this week that we had published an article, Things That Are Hard to Grow in the Desert, and says, well, I've been growing them for 30 years here in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And he sent in a picture. And he had a couple takeaways from that.
Well, you know, it's close to the house, so it's somewhat protected. And you know, bananas in particular, there's been bananas people growing. We had one at our Mesa location when we had that, a great big banana plant that produced edible bananas. But again, it was in a very protected spot from cold and from wind. If you look at the leaves on that banana tree, they're all shredded. You know, they're big old soft leaf, so they aesthetically don't always look very good because the wind just tears the heck out of them if they're in a windy spot. And they're super cold sensitive, so they've got to be in a protected spot, and then probably even then some years they're going to freeze back. Hard to grow is different than impossible. I mean, you can grow it.
It's only impossible at my address.
But we always tell people, you know, if they did really well here, they'd be all over the place. Mm. I mean, who wouldn't want a banana in their front yard? Or an avocado or a mango? I mean, they'd be everywhere. Doesn't mean you can't grow them. Just means it's probably not for the faint of heart to grow.
You got to have lots of time on your hand.
Yeah, or just the right spot. You know, what we call microclimates, little nooks or crannies around the house or next to other plants that they create those spots that are more humid, are more shady, are warmer, or, you know, whatever. You can sneak little things like bananas and tropical fruits and different things in there, and they'll work. But you have to know your microclimates and know how to manage them and know what you're looking to do.
I have found I can grow a pomegranate. I've got a pomegranate tree I've cut to the ground and poured, drilled quarter-inch drill bit holes into the trunk, saturated with stump killer, and it still grows.
It's meant to be there.
I don't think I'd eat the pomegranate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm trying to kill that tree 5 or 6 times. Man, it's as big as you are, Roby.
Quit fighting that one.
Well, we've got wrapping up here. We're right in our lawn transition time. Any?
Yeah. So as we talked about earlier in the show, at the beginning of the show, especially with kind of more normal temperatures now coming back, you don't fight the fact that ryegrass is wanting to kind of crap out. Don't start watering it more to keep it green. We want to cut the water down or leave it the same. Mow that lawn short. Dethatch it. Get that ryegrass out of there, so that underlying hybrid or Bermuda grass can start to recover and get growing, because it will only stay dormant so long. And if you let that ryegrass go a whole lot longer, when it does finally die, and it will, you won't have any lawn left. You'll be stuck with either reseeding or letting it have to fill in from around the edges, and that can take a long time.
And you're off to Harper's Nursery on Hayden Road?
Hayden Road, just south of Thomas. Got new fresh flowers in, ready to go for that summer stuff.
And you're open till?
Till 4:30.
Sign up for the Rosie on the House weekly newsletter. It's filled with timely gardening and home improvement advice, as well as special offers and discounts you can't find anywhere else. That's rosieonthehouse.com.